As I'm being followed by a moon shadow, moon shadow, moon shadow. Leaping and hopping on a moon shadow, moon shadow, moon shadow. And if I ever lose my hands, lose my plow, lose my land, oh, if I ever lose my hands away, I won't have to work no more. And if I ever lose my eyes, if my colors all run dry, yes, if I ever lose my eyes away, I won't have to cry no more.
The sun came up on the morrow and was hot in the afternoon. Now it did not rain for several months. The mountain pass, which this cascade had opened before them, was a luminous threshold to a new journey. It was now a journey of separation. Looking backwards upon the waking prairie, they left their nation, and looking forward and upward, they did not know to what or where they were. The Indian encountered now had never seen white men, and would avoid them. So much of what was to be seen was unfamiliar to them as well. It marveled them. The core was a scientific adventure, and the captain's task given to him by an intellectual president was to methodically inventory the flora and fauna which he discovered. Here, there was so much new encountered, so much unknown and strange, that its number and scope challenged him. His journals, wherein he recorded his catalogs, were already almost filled when he arrived to this country. He scribbled in the margins to make room for new items that he found. He was charged to preserve specimens where he could, plants especially, but insects, pickled dead animals too. And they had collected now so many that they exhausted their capacity to carry them, and choosing which to forego was vexing. There was so much discovered that he could not record or retain all that he wished. Gradually, in this surfeit of the extraordinary and diverse, the wilderness became alien. The animals that were known to them receded as they climbed in elevation and more deeply penetrated the unknown landscape. Animals, all living things, became more and more scarce and remote to see. Where there had been a plenty of bison and endless grassy plains, there was only empty space, arid and sparse, and empty of life of any kind. Hunting became difficult and fruitless. Stark mountains stood around them on all sides. The passages through them were arduous, tortuous, and dangerous. Water was alkaline, often undrinkable. The nights were frigid and resisted the dawn. Strange as the night calls were, stranger still was the uncanny silence when wind died in the darkness. In the hunter's mind, the sylph of sleep spoke. He feared. He saw the world had abandoned them. In a raving, he thought and wondered, did he speak this thought out loud? The world is made for insects that do not thirst, because we who thirst must die. Unblinking death behind us steps in the gravel. The fiddler died. He was dead one night without a word. He was buried without a word. They put his fiddle in his grave. They all knew what this meant. Afterwards, as they traveled, without speaking mostly, they found the constant sunlight, once longed for during unrelenting rain, a new and more relentless despair. The air was dry, and they were parched for thirst most of the time, and drinking the alkaline waters would worsen their condition, but of course they did. They got so they had hardly any jerky or cornmeal left, and nothing else to eat but their leather clothing. The hunter found nothing but a varmint or two in his ever wider circle for the core, and these he fed to his dog, or kept to maintain himself. 5 miles out, I spied an Indian on horseback, about 2 miles distant. I came up on him as he on me. He must have seen me also, and as curious as I. From his dress, I guessed that he was of a different nation from any that we had yet seen. He was Shoshone, I guessed. His arms were a bow and quiver, and he was mounted without a saddle. A raw hide string muzzled the jaw of the horse, which made a kind of bridle. I was happy at the sight of this stranger, and had no doubt of obtaining a friendly introduction to his nation, provided I could get near enough him to convince him that I was friendly myself. I proceeded towards him at my casual pace, but when I had got within half a mile, he made a halt after splashing through a creek that crossed between us, and so I stopped too. I knelt while speaking what words I hoped he understood, and unwrapped my blanket from my pack. Then I made him the signal of friendship known to the Indians of Missouri, which is by holding a blanket or buffalo robe in your hands at two corners and throwing it up in the air over your head and bringing it to the earth in the air softly as if the act of spreading it, and repeating this 3 times. But that signal had not the desired effect. He still kept his position and seemed to view me with suspicion. I thought I must offer him something, but in my searching my gear, I think I distressed him further, and he turned his horse about, gave him a kick in its gut, and he leapt the creek, and he trotted off into the willow brush, and with him vanished all my hopes of obtaining a horse such as his. The captain was excited by this news, and glad to guess it was Shoshone, because his Indian guide was Shoshone, and he was certain now we could recover our adventure and save ourselves. He sent men out with instructions to the place where I had seen the Indian, and they put down an American flag on an espantoon. And he visited the place himself, bringing his woman guide with him, where she and he now shouted into the woods with Shoshone words. But they heard nothing, not even echo. The calls went out with the wind to distances that did not reply. After 2 days of travel, however, they saw 2 women, a man, and some dogs on a ridge. They appeared to be looking upon them with attention, and 2 of them, after a few minutes, sat down. When they had approached within half a mile of them, they halted, and once again the captain attached the unfurled flag to his espontoon and advanced alone toward them. The women turned and left, but the individual man remained until the captain stood below him at the base of the ridge, gestured toward him, and began to slowly mount the slope, at which the lone man also rose unhurriedly, and passed over without looking back, and went out of sight beyond the ridge. The dogs were less shy, but they too scampered off before the captain could crest the point where they had stood. And while he stood there and looked about and down the other side, it was apparent to the corps he did not see them. He returned and said nothing. When I went alone again to hunt with no success, I surprised 3 female savages. The short and steep ravines between which we were passing one another concealed us from each other until we came within a space where these intersected like canyons meeting. And there I stood within 30 paces of them. A young woman immediately took flight. An elderly woman and a girl of about 12 years old remained. I instantly laid down my gun, and advanced toward them. But they appeared much alarmed, and saw that I was too near for them to escape by flight, so they therefore sat down, holding their heads as if reconciled to die, which they expected, no doubt, would be their fate. I took the elderly woman by her hand and raised her up, repeated the word Tababon, and drew up my shirt sleeve to show her my pale skin, to prove to her I was a white man, because my face and hands, which had been constantly exposed to the sun, were as dark as her own. That gesture, or my word, or both, had the effect I hoped. She laughed and helped the child to stand, and the two of them delighted to look at me and wanted to see my naked chest and legs. Suddenly a host of warriors on horseback came out of the canyon in which the young woman had run. But as the old woman was touching me and smiling at me, and the child also plainly safe with me, they drew their horses up short. I saw behind them a crowd of other Indians coming, the entire tribe, assembled to witness me. The hunter led the assembly toward the car, where the captain, seeing them, waved his flag despontoon vigorously. The parties, civilized and savage, now converged upon one another happily as a family meeting and reunion. Some of both sides ran to greet one another, and indeed, it were in part the truth of circumstance, for these were the self-same people of the Corps' Indian guide, and she made signs to the captain that these were her nation by sucking her fingers. The men coming up took out of their packs and offered the women some beads they had, and awls, and pewter looking glasses. The women, in turn, now painted the men's cheeks with some vermilion, which for this nation is emblematic of peace. The warriors mounted on horses came up riding at nearly full speed and surrounded the captain in whoops and gestures as the captain mightily waved his flag. Now, all at once dismounting, the multitude of them milling and intermingling, the warriors all embraced the white men very affectionately, putting their left arms over their right shoulders, clasping their backs, and pressing their left cheeks to the white man and pronouncing the words, "Ahia, ahia," that is, "I am very happy." Everyone caressed everyone, and everyone was besmeared with vermilion paint until some of the whites were tired of this national hugging and begged to distance themselves by attending to their gear. At last, in the spot where they had found themselves, the warriors all sat in a circle facing each other and pulled off their moccasins and made to smoke a pipe. "Kima'awa," they said, repeatedly, gesturing to the white man to sit with him. "Kima'awa, come and smoke." This was the custom, as was explained, a sacred obligation of sincerity in the profession of friendship, the act of receiving and smoking the pipe of a stranger, having first removed their moccasins, as if to say that they might wish they may always go barefoot if they are not sincere. And a terrible penalty it would be if they were to be barefoot among these prickly pear. The Indians, singing loudly, led the corps, and all the women and children with them in a mass to their own encampment in a shaded wood at the rear of a near canyon where there was a sort of oasis with a stream cascading from the mountain, which splashed into a pool and fed some underground spring. The woman, the Indian guide, ran ahead and embraced a tall man as he rose from his sitting place, astonished. This proved to be the brother of the woman guide, Kamaya White, a chief of deserved renown, far and wide among the tribes of their nation, a statuesque person of patient, reserved manner and elegant speech. The Indians sang for a long time in their camp, happy for the reunion of their long-lost kin. Kamawayate himself braided into the captain's hair several strands of small, round seashell pieces, resembling pearl buttons, highly valued by his people, which were brought from other nations near the seacoast. The captain then gave to Kamawayate the flag and his espontoon that he told him was an emblem of peace among white men, and now received by him, it was to be respected as a bond of union. Through his interpreter, the woman guide, who was effusive with her tearful joy and touched her brother as she spoke to him like children do, the captain related that they had not had any food since the evening before. The chief replied that they had nothing but berries to eat, but offered to share what little they had, a kind of sticky plug cake made of service berries and choke cherries, which had been dried in the sun. Everything about the corps and the white men appeared to astonish them. Their appearance, their guns, their speech, and of course, the black servant. The tribe collected about their lodges and indulged themselves with looking at and touching the white men, these being the first white persons they'd ever seen. Some also were intrigued with the hunter's dog, who stayed close to him, and so they thought must obey him at an unspoken thought. For, as he saw, there were no dogs in their own camp. The captain made inquiries about the seashells woven into his hair and was told about the people of the Columbia River, the landscape there, the game, and so on. The account they gave was full of apprehension. That the river raged, that one falls of which was perpendicular and higher than the falls of Missouri, and at a place where the mountains were so tightly enclosed as to be impassable. They also learned of the current privations of these people, that there were no deer, elk, or any game to be found. They told also how they were harassed by another nation of Indians, with whom they must compete for the meager game, the Blackfoot, whom they despised, and who despised them, and who migrated at will through their land and often compelled them to move about in those barren mountains to escape them. And so at this time they were half-starved, living solely on berries and roots which they might gather in the high plains. But even impoverished, the Shoshone were very generous with what they had, and the hunger of the corps was assuaged for a time. The parties made trade. The corps wanted horses. The Shoshone saw the advantage of guns. It was a fair exchange for both, and the corps had been equipped for this eventuality. And the captain shrewdly foresaw the dependency upon the whites which this exchange shall mean. For once armed this way, or hunting this way, the Indians shall be continuously in need of powder and shot, which they did not and could not manufacture. Other men should become faithful go-between for many years in the future. Signifying that enduring relationship, the hunter offered then to take them on a hunt, in which he might train them in the usage of the gun. The offer was met with misgivings. The use of guns was well desired, the want of meat was sore. But the adventure should mean the encounter with their enemies, and of this they were rightly afraid. The captain reassured them. He did not doubt the superiority of the corps to master them. And besides, said he, we should be friendly. We should offer to them the same surety as we offer thee. The chief addressed his warriors several times before they would move. They seemed very reluctant to accompany the expedition. At length the captain asked the reason and was told that some among them had suggested the idea that the corps was in league with the Blackfoot and intended to decoy them into an ambuscade where their enemies were waiting to receive them. Kamawayate said he did not believe it. The captain told Kamawayate that he was sorry to find that they put so little confidence in him and the President of the United States, whom he called the great father, in the manner of the Indian phrase. He said, I know you are not acquainted with white men, and therefore can forgive you your misapprehension. But among white men, it is considered disgraceful to lie or entrap either friend or enemy by any falsehood. Then he added craftily this challenge. Even if you do not believe me, I hope there are some among you that are not afraid to die. That proved the right bell to sound. To doubt the bravery of a savage is to put an insult to his face. There were many, even most of them, and all the young warriors certainly, who would come. Several of the old women were crying and imploring the Great Spirit to protect their warriors as if they were going to a certain death. The hunter, entrusted with leadership, rode out on a horseback amidst a following crowd of such wailing and weeping. It was a premature funeral parade. The captain and most of the corps stayed with Kamawait. Some looked upon his stay suspiciously, while others entertained the opportunity to murder them if revenge were necessary. But the mood of suspicion passed, and the hunter had not proceeded far before his party was swelled by 10 or 12 more, coming and joining from behind. And before they reached the creek, which he had passed in the morning when he had first spied a brave on horseback, it seemed that he had perhaps almost all the men of the village, except for Kamawait, and quite a number of young women with them. Now they were very cheerful and gay, chattered earnestly as they went until a certain place, undistinguished in any way the hunter could tell. But suddenly they were quite wary, and he saw the women and most of the men had dropped behind to stay and had set a camp to wait on them. They came at last to meadowlands, sloping toward the Yellowstone River, fringed with copse of birch and aspen intermingled, where there bloomed an ocean of late summer weeds, a meandering, luxuriant ribbon of blue lupine, within a high grassy greenery, following its own secret way, or perhaps the wandering track of a springtime creek subsiding where a moistened bed nourished them lushly. Deer in several families were seen in spots, doe and yearlings and fawns who had outgrown their spotted camouflage. Here and there, browsing nicely, the hunter dismounting and crouching, his dog hid and slinking amongst the lupine and tall grasses with him, crept forward, and at a clear, long shot, brought down a deer, a companion at his side bringing down a second in an instant. The others flew away. Immediately dismounted, the Indians ran in tumbling over each other and like a pack of famished dogs began seizing and tearing away at the bodies and limbs of the fallen deer, opening them and devouring the intestines and the warm organs of them, raw and bloody though they be. It was a scene to be imagined only for hell. But the hunter thought, I know I'm no less an animal than they. Were I as hungry, I would do the same. Each one had a piece of some description, and all eating most ravenously. Some were eating the kidneys, some heart or liver, the blood running from the corners of their mouths. Others were in similar situation with the paunch and guts, extruding substances into their mouths, which the white man would have thought filth. One had provided himself with about 9 feet of the small intestine, one end of which he was chewing on, while with his hands he squeezed the contents out at the other. The corps, but for the hunter, were nauseated to view these poor starved devils and stood back amazed, but the hunter set to skin the deer, bled and butchered them, and reserving a quarter for the corps, gave the major balance to several to take back to those who waited and those remaining at the village. These several warriors soon rode off with the skinned carcasses across their horses' necks, while the hunter made fire and cooked a dinner for those who stayed with him. In the morrow, they resumed the hunt and found the deer returned to browse at the dawn, on the windward side, away from the human scent, and though wary, softly entered the meadow and gave him another clear shot, and again they dropped two. Again he divided the meat for the benefit of the Indian in mind, and again warriors left with meat to feed to the tribe. He took the larger portion of the morning to teach and to practice shooting with the young braves whom he still had in his charge. Then in the afternoon they proceeded further into the territory where at any time they may encounter the enemy, the Blackfoot, or the Sioux. It was soon that they were found. The gunshot had brought them, of course, as the hunter had expected. But he knew his presumptive enemy would not have guessed the Shoshone were their companions, and would have ridden out precipitately to encounter white men whom they likely knew from previous encounter, whom at least their brethren Sioux may have introduced to them, if not otherwise. Their customs and dress had been described to the hunter by some of the Frenchmen he had met, who must have seen them face to face. He had been told they were fierce and untrustworthy, but his captain had declared they should attempt a peace with them. It was the president's wish to offer peace to all Indians. As if it were the feared ambuscade, however, they found themselves confronted and surrounded in a clearing before a half-circle grove of quaking aspen. The portion of the corps which he led, the three white men and he, and perhaps six or seven Shoshone, surrounded by three or four dozen Blackfoot in war paint, afoot and on horseback, filtering from the trees, painted for war but silent. Some horses anxiously whinnied. The presence of their natural enemies should have made these Blackfoot immediately inclined to attack, but they withheld assault. They were clearly superior in numbers, but they had no grievance with the whites, and prudently noted their guns. Seeing guns in the hands of their Indian enemy, however, dismayed some who earnestly counseled murder. The hunter understood the predicament, and knew he must act out the fate of the circumstance without vacillation. He beckoned to the Blackfoot, who appeared before him, and seemed to command his party. One of his Shoshone comrades could speak their language, and so the hunter dismounted and stood beside his horse, and advanced upon a Blackfoot cadre of four that now dismounted, and approached in the opposing direction. This Indian interpreter accompanied him, his dog beside him also. The hunter cradled his gun across his forearm. He stopped within 10 feet of them. The Blackfoot stopped, and the hunter greeted them, his words translated. One of the Blackfoot spoke French in reply, and so the hunter spoke to him freely. The conversation was peremptory. The Blackfoot presumed the malice of the whites. The hunter worried upon the sly movements around him, his frustrated efforts to dissuade him of his bitter anxieties, as evidenced by the Indian's undisguised contempt, increased his own. The Blackfoot wanted guns, offered some in exchange for joining them in a small number of a brief journey. The Blackfoot replied they would have the guns which the Shoshone possessed. This the hunter could not assent to, even under less difficult circumstance. But under this one, had he even paused to consider the request, it should have been interpreted as a dangerous betrayal by the Shoshone. The hunter immediately and instinctively explained they were not his guns to give, But if the speaker and his brothers wished to go with him, and an equal number of their party, they would take them to his chief, who would happily make a worthy gift to him. This reply was not well received. And the Blackfoot, whom the hunter sensed was arrogant and quick to intemperance, reached out for a gun of the Shoshone to take it from him forcibly. But the Shoshone drew back, and when again the Blackfoot reached for it, presuming to take it as he might a child's possession, the Shoshone struck his head with the butt of the gun, slashing his cheek and stunning him. And the altercation began. Without further consideration, the hunter shot and killed the Blackfoot on horseback, to whom he had first beckoned and had taken to be the leader, though he had delegated to this other unconscious one for the unfortunate parley. The men of the corps responded like soldiers, turning back to back and shooting outwards at the flanks and striking various Blackfoots surrounding them. The Shoshone, less certain of their weapons, whether to use them as clubs or to shoot them, hesitated until the main body of Blackfoot turned to ride or run away, and then shot after them, missing them. That the Blackfoot had so quickly departed and left three dead and two wounded puzzled his peers. But the hunter understood it, and he rushed to his horse and bade everyone follow him at a gallop. They overtook the encampment breaking up before them and hastened them back to the village. He was confident the Blackfoot would not follow this day, but it is likely they would someday soon avenge themselves. He reported to his captain what had occurred. Kamawayate was grimly aware of the consequences, and expressed his despondence so keenly that the captain was humbled in his folly, and offered the chief larger portions of powder and shot, and more guns than he had anticipated giving to him. The Blackfoot were the only Indian that the Corps of Discovery encountered with any consequential hostility, and the only Indian that they killed. The incident would result in lasting enmity between their nation and the United States of America, and should bring upon the hunter his crowning mortal test. But as no attack occurred, and the season of winter advancing, the captain determined to depart and made to the Pacific and their ultimate objective. He divided the corps into two parties, one party to proceed by horseback and a second party by river course. The captain himself would lead men furnished with axes and other necessary tools for making canoes, their arms, accoutrements, and such other supplies as they should require. They would attempt to traverse the tributaries and their falls to the seaward Columbia. In the meantime, the hunter was to take a party on horseback, bearing the larger portion of gear and the scientific collection of the expedition, and seek a circuitous route through the mountains and rejoin them once they struck the Columbia and found pathways beside it. The Shoshone told them how well and diversely peopled were these many cascading cliffs to this great river, where peoples lived in sheltered and isolate ravines along tributaries to it, and thrived upon salmon and fruit and nuts, and knew little meat-eating. They told them to expect them to be friendly, for they had formerly encountered white men who had come by the sea. The most remarkable aspect of the journey was how swift and unremarkable it was. The autumn fell upon them, and now well out of the mountains, the golden quaking aspen behind them, they found themselves among prodigious firs and a forest floor abounding with fern, like a waist-high swamp of them, and an incessant, fine, and dreary rain falling. And if it did not rain, it misted. And if not misting, it was a fog. The captain reached the Pacific before the hunter, and his party found them. Finding them on the south shore, across such a vast and perilous bay at the estuary to the Pacific, whose name here was belied by terrible tides, they failed repeatedly to join them. The hunter was forced to retrace several dozen miles before he found a passable ford, and even there he lost a horse, and with it some of the precious journals of the expedition. The captain punished him with promises to withhold pay, but to this the hunter was indifferent, because he did not expect to collect it. The winter at the fort that was built was continually sodden and morose. It rained continuously, the skies continuously overcast. So sodden was the air, and so sodden was everything that they possessed, that everything leather rotted, and they soon wished they had kept the broadcloth, which they had previously thrown away. Such stores which they had quickly spoiled in this clime. Meal molded, jerky went fetid, and poisonous to eat. They found the Indian were stoic survivors of such wintering, fasting much, and generally not complaining of having less to eat than these white men. The rain and wet weather became the matter of most conversation and comment, until it was so continual as to be normal, and the sunlight and the drying of goods and persons was uncommon, and made for comment instead. The food at first was easy to find, and these Indians, the Nez Perce, were ready to communicate and exchange, as the Shoshone had said. And their women proved to be the most eager sexual partners of all the Indians they had met. Indeed, they were also the most commonly sexually diseased among all the Indians who gave themselves, often revealing weeping sores, and many of the corps contracted syphilitic pox from them during the long, wet winter which was spent among them. In this extremity, the corps slaughtered and ate recently foaled colts, and considered eating some of the horses. But the Nez Perce gave them dogs to eat out of their compassion. Dog, it was learned, was the staple among them, just as in Pennsylvania one might eat pork. The captain allowed, with little encouragement, that dog meat was good to eat, and acquired an appetite for its taste.